suffer. For the want of immunity or a bone of rest. Well, who would hold the price on the heads of the innocent children? If there's an immortal power to control the
okay, that was Rush, and you're listening to Radio Free Thinker on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan. I am the freethinking historian, and I am joined by our good friend, Don.
Hello, this is Don, the philosopher in political science. This day in history, in 1804, Alcuin, an English monk who was the chief advisor to Charles the Great, managed to lobby Charlemagne to abolish the death penalty for pagans in 1797. That's important for us locally because ending today is the GIA Gathering, which is a Canadian National Pagan Conference that's happening right here at UBC. If there are any of you pagans out there who'd be interested in our show, please feel free to give us an email and we'd be interested to talk to you. We tend to focus a lot on Judeo-Christians, but we'll deal with any religion or any beliefs if you want.
Yeah, and we're very happy that you're not going to be executed, and we look forward to hearing from you. And also, on this day in history, in 1868, something pretty interesting happened in America. President Andrew Johnson was acquitted in his impeachment trial by one vote in the United States Senate. So, a bit of a reprieve on slavery as well.
Why was he being impeached?
Well, Johnson was a bit of a drunk and not a really good president, actually, and was basically attempting to roll back the clock on the reforms Lincoln was quite famous for bringing in. Actually, interesting story about Andrew Johnson is that because he was the vice president, if he was impeached, the presidency would not have passed to the Speaker of the House, as it does in today's age, but to the head of the Senate, who was a man by the name of Ben Wade. And Ben Wade would have really changed American politics because he was in favor of land reform.
Ooh.
And who knows what would have happened then if Mr. Wade had become president.
Well, judging by that time, the American Marines would have come in and had an overthrow of the government. They tend to do that whenever someone talked about land reform.
Yeah, let's move on.
Well, you know, it's also interesting, sorry, on the same kind of note. In 1896, the Plessy versus Ferguson ruling in the United States came through, which was the whole one that's introduced the whole idea of segregation in the United States. It was the one that said you could have equal but separate but equal accommodations, right? And it's coincidental that that happened on the same day that Johnson was acquitted of his impeachment.
Yeah, I guess the whole trend of slavery has a way of connecting itself, doesn't it?
You know, it's funny, too. While they're sitting there, they were dealing with all of the slavery issue. Another interesting thing, and there's lots that happened this day in history. In 1920, in Montreal, Quebec, radio station XWA broadcast the first regularly scheduled program in North America. It was a Canadian first.
Yeah, and quite a good thing because, you know, descending from that, we have CITR and we have us, the Radio Free Thinker, the show promoting skepticism and critical thinking. So remember to tune in. And we'll be right back after this station ID.
UBC Alumni Weekend, May 22nd to 24th, brings together all the great things you remember from your years at UBC, only better. You'll hear great lectures by top profs with no exams at the end. Taste the new alumni wine offerings like Wrecked Beach Pinot Noir and Bacchus Laureate Chardonnay. Listen to great music over a Mahoney's barbecued burger and tour the campus to see all the changes and all the things that have stayed the same. And bring the kids. There's balloons, bubbles, and baseball too. Alumni Weekend starts on Friday night with a discussion on UBC's future with President Stephen Toop. It gets provocative on Saturday night with a panel on today's economic woes, moderated by Jeffrey Simpson, and ends on Sunday with tide pooling in Stanley Park. Call 604 827-3081 for more info or visit www.alumni.bc.ca to sign up for these events.
This is Phil Plait of BadAstronomy.com, and I'll be a guest on an upcoming Radio Free Thinkers show. Take some time and listen in. Radio Free Thinkers are on every Tuesday at 4 p.m. here on CITR 101.9 FM.
Hello, we're back. So, just for everyone out there, there's an interesting thing coming up. It's called TAM.
It's, what was that, Don?
That's what happens when you have call waiting turned off.
Wow. But getting back to TAM.
TAM, yes. It is the Amazing Meeting. It's held by JREF, the James Randi Foundation. It's an amazing meeting that celebrates critical thinking and skepticism. It's happening on July 9th to 12th in Las Vegas. So it's basically a convention for skeptics. On the topic of conventions, there's actually a thing coming up. It's the Skeptic Convention. But we have a little piece for that.
Yep, and here it is.
Hello, and we're back. There's coming up in San Francisco a conference on conspiracy. It's a conspiracy series conference. Such a bizarre idea. A bunch of people going around plotting about how to get rid of other people who are plotting against them. Or at least that's one
thing. I've never heard of this conspiracy theory conference. Who told you this?
Well, you know, it's hard to find, but if you know the right people, you can't go to the major media because they're all part of it. No. If you look on the internet, conspiracy conference, there's a thing in there. But I was just thinking to myself, I mean, what kind of people show up with this? The presenters I can see, I did some research into some of the presenters that are going to show up there, and I won't mention anyone's name, but all of them have usually something to sell. Most of them either have a bunch of books based exclusively on conspiracy theory. Some of them actually have products that they're selling, cure-alls and that type of thing.
Well, this
one
is,
or
this
two
is
of them are just media personalities.
This is probably true of most conventions. I mean, you can't pan a convention just because the people there are trying to sell some merchandise. That's why we have conventions.
That's true. I went to a unnamed convention, and people were selling unnamed products. I don't want to name them because I'll sound like a nerd, but...
Star Trek?
Maybe.
It's when you start talking about the Babylon 5 toys you bought. Then you've hit major nerd city. But my point was, I can understand why the presenters are there. I mean, they if they believe truly, sure. If they don't believe truly, they have a motive. But what kind of people off the street would show up? Would you show up for one of these conspiracy conventions?
Well, I would be curious. I would actually be curious to see what they would say.
Yeah, I'd be interested in seeing to say, you know, what kind of evidence they have for a conspiracy going on, and what they think the conspiracy is about. I mean,
well, what about, I mean, like I say, a lot of them are about 9/11. I mean, haven't we kind of beat that one to death?
Well, the thing with conspiracy theories, and I think James Randi mentioned this, they're the unsinkable rubber ducks, and that once the idea is out there, it's not going to go away. It's just going to get modified over the years to take into account all the evidence we've thrown against it. So it might be interesting just to see what the other side is coming up with.
I can see that. I think another thing that plays into, too, for the people who show up who are genuine believers is the whole idea of the social element. I mean, I can see if you believe in a particular wild conspiracy theory to come across other people who have similar unique ideas.
Yeah, it's like it's sort of a validation of your point of view. If you can find other people who think the same way as you do and believe the same things, it's like you've got support.
But then, of course, you can't confuse a lot of people having similar ideas as to be proof of it. I mean, there's always...
Oh, definitely not.
That's the logical fallacy of numbers, of saying, well, 9 million people believe what I believe, so I must be right.
But that's a reason for showing up at a conference.
So if you were going to show up at this conference and you were listening to some of these things, what sort of skeptical skills would you be bringing to this to pick out the hyperbole from perhaps there is some nuggets? I mean, everything at some time probably was a conspiracy theory, and some of them, rare occasion, are true. Let's not forget Kennedy.
I think the most important skill you can bring to these sorts of conventions or anybody talking about conspiracy theories is fact-checking. You should be able to find the sources that they're citing, or if they're not citing any sources, find out where the fact they're telling you came from and check to see whether it's accurate or not.
Actually, on that note, I noticed some of the articles written by people here. They had footnotes, and usually the footnotes were on a different page, but I went and I looked at their footnotes, and it had MSNBC. No date, no time, no article.
Just MSNBC.
They were listening to the radio, and they heard someone that they thought might have said that. So not only do they have to be sourced, but they have to be a very valid, a proper kind of footnoting involved. But what else?
Well, I think any kind of critical thinking skill set you can bring would be very beneficial. I think we talked about this before, but if you're going to present an idea that the government, say, planned 9/11, you need to bring with it enough evidence to make it reasonable. You can't just say they planned it because the government is evil. You need a bit more to go on. And anyone with critical thinking skills should say, wait a second here, that's a pretty darn extraordinary claim. Let me see your extraordinary evidence to go with it.
I think on that, too, is even if you sit there and you say, well, this is a plausible thing, I can weave together this big, massive conspiracy, or it was a bunch of crazy people who took over a plane and crashed it into the night. Which one is more likely, a very simplistic one, or one that requires you to weave together the past history of the human race for 500 years?
Yeah, the more people that have to be involved in the conspiracy, I mean, you know, perpetuating it, you know, covering it up, you know, tracking down the right people, the more people that have to be involved for the conspiracy to work, the less likely it is to be true, because people as a whole tend to be rather disagreeable.
It's true. And the more you make the conspiracy theory bigger, the more factors are involved. And it just becomes a huge organizational effort. And you have to wonder, how can this effort be concealed so well? You'd think that people who wrote the memos, that mailed the memos to the people saying, remember, we have a conspiracy meeting at 5, those letters should show up.
If your main evidence for a conspiracy theory is that there is no evidence, then you've got to rethink your position.
There's one last thing, maybe just to close up this particular segment. Do you think that by allowing, and I know this is a little heavy-handed, by allowing these conventions to go on, we're not actually perpetuating falsehoods in the community? I mean, let's say 9/11 isn't true or something like that. If you allow them to go on, isn't there some, and going way out there, equivalent to something like allowing racists to sit out there and they have conferences about Holocaust denial, which is part of the skeptical community? Is there some point where we should sit there and say, well, listen, you know, conspiracy theories may have a place, but there's a time and a place where they go too far. Should we be policing these in some way?
Well, censorship is a topic for a whole other show. But I think in general that if you have conferences where people are going to, you know, present perhaps not so critical viewpoints, the best thing you can do is ask the organizers of these conferences if you can come present a skeptical viewpoint, a skeptical counterpoint to the other things that are being presented at these conferences.
And sometimes it helps to just let these people talk, because oftentimes if you present what they say exactly as they say it, you'll just demonstrate their level of understanding and their level of critical thinking. It'll become very obvious just how much skepticism they employ. I think that same with the Holocaust denial clubs that they have. I think that trying to stamp these things out may sound ethical and great, but sometimes if you just let them go, they'll make a big enough fool themselves on their own that we don't even have to do anything.
So we'd love to hear from our listeners what they think about conspiracy theories. If you think that we landed on the moon, write in to radio.freethinker@gmail.com and tell us so.
Okay, so that was a pretty interesting debate. And now we're going to be going to a new segment that our buddy Rob has come up with while he's off in Europe. Skeptical Dispatches from a Skeptic.
Dispatches from a Skeptical Traveler. Sopot is a resort town on the Baltic Sea in the north of Poland, and is renowned as a place to come and rejuvenate at one of its many sanatoriums,
with massage, exercise, and great healthy food. I've spent some time looking at some sanatorium websites, and they advertise some incredible health benefits. They treat whatever ails you: back pain, spinal injuries, rheumatoid arthritis, asthma, heart conditions, and all while making you look younger and feel healthier. Sounds pretty amazing. The treatments that do all of these amazing things vary wildly. There's a balneotherapy, in which you take mud baths or bathe in brine. There's inhalation, which involves breathing deeply while under heated quartz lamps. There's laser therapy, magnetronics, and something called Scottish whips, which I decided not to look up. My favorite was cryotherapy, which supposedly stops aging and removes scars, as well as helping back pain and generally re-energizing your whole body. And the way it works is that you sit in a box which is lowered to a temperature of minus 150 degrees Celsius. That's what it says on this website, at least, which features cryotherapy as one of its best treatments. It costs 240 zloty, roughly equivalent to $90 Canadian. When one of the best treatments available is sitting in a giant fridge, my warning bells go off. I have nothing against exercise and eating healthily, but when you start making medical claims, you'd better have proof that they work. Unfortunately, nowhere on any of these sites are there any citations from clinical trials. I tried to look up a number of the treatments on quackwatch.org and whatstheharm.net, and most of the ones I checked out were pretty much panned by actual medical science. A couple of them I couldn't find, inhalation for example, but I'm willing to bet that any sanatorium that offers such a wide variety of quackery isn't going to have many treatments that have actually been proven to work. Tune in next week for another dispatch from a skeptical traveler.
Okay, and we thank our good buddy Rob for that. But before we do anything else, it's time to go for a commercial break.
Hey, this is Steve Nash. You're listening to CITR 101.9, the home of the UBC Thunderbirds.
I'm gonna be around my vegetables. I'm gonna chow down my vegetables. I love you most of all, my favorite vegetable.
Sprouts. It's your 75-cent coffee fix in the sub. It's your source for reasonably priced, creatively named stew and vegan brownies. It's your purveyor of bicycle-delivered local produce. It's also a place where volunteers can realize their vision of responsible business and where like-minded students can explore UBC's food systems. Hark! Sprouts is currently accepting applications for next year's executive board and is encouraging ambitious, creative, and disciplined students from all faculties and year levels to apply. Come by Sprouts in the sub-basement to learn more about our projects and how to get involved.
I tried to kick the ball, but my tenny flew right off. I'm red as a bee, 'cause I'm so embarrassed.
Okay, and we're back. And Don, you got something to tell us.
Yeah, last semester I took a course in ethics, and one of the books we were reading was called Lack of Character, and it had a really interesting study. Researchers were testing seminary students. These are students who are planning to go into the priesthood, right? They had a test that was set up that they would go and they do a written assignment, and then they were told to hurry across the campus where they were going to perform an oral assignment. Now, of course, the real test had nothing to do with the written or the oral one. What was being tested was their response to finding someone who's prone on the street between the two assignments. So they would be told, you know, hurry up, you've got 5 minutes to get to the next one, or hurry up, you know, you're late, or hurry up, you should have been there 5 minutes ago. There were different degrees of hurriedness. And on the path, they would come across a person who was prone on the ground. And some of them had to walk over this person, right? They were in clear distress. And they wanted to test how often would someone stop under those conditions. And surprisingly enough, they found that people who were under the very hurried conditions, 90% of the time, they just walked right over them and kept going. And I mean, these were the people who are studying to be, you know, healers of and all that of society. I just thought that was quite an interesting thing, because quite often there's a dichotomy between how atheists have no moral foundation, or even agnostics are weak in moral foundations, and religious people seem to have, you know, they've got the Bible and all that, and it doesn't always seem to point out in actual behavior of people.
Yeah, and that's sort of a criticism that's kind of labeled at atheists, is that where do atheists get their morals from? And we kind of talked about this before, about the Bible being not exactly the most moral book out there. But it is kind of an interesting question, because people who are religious and maybe identify themselves more as being a religious person as opposed to being another political bent, maybe, generally have some interesting ideas about things like capital punishment, the use of torture, these sort of issues.
Well, it's funny you mentioned the use of torture. There's a survey put out by the Pew Forum on Religion that made a comment that the more religious someone is, the more likely they are willing to support torture. They had pointed out that evangelical Protestants were 62% in favor of torture, compared to quote-unquote unaffiliateds, who were only 40% affiliated. It's even worse than that. One could argue that those who say they are religious might not really be churchers, but they did a survey of people who went to church regularly as opposed to those who didn't go regularly. And even in that case, you found that 44% of those who regularly, that's like more than once a week, went to church, were in favor of torture, as compared to 42% who would rarely or never attend a church.
So there actually is a noticeable difference in how often you go to church compared referring to how you feel about torture. And I suppose we could even say, you know, there might even be certain situations where torture could be considered permissible. Perhaps if you had a ticking time bomb situation like they do in 24. Of course, how often that happens in real life remains to be seen.
True, true. You know, and that leads into a whole other issue, right? I mean, we were talking before the show that there's sort of a soft form of this and a hard form of this. I mean, the soft form would sit there and say, well, people develop their own sense of morals from their self. And in that sense, you know, atheists aren't any more moral or less moral than religious people. But then, of course, then there's a hard form of that same argument that would go that, well, because religious people have this, sort of get-out-of-jail-free card. I mean, you always have the thing that on your deathbed, you can recant all of your sins and they will all be forgiven. And in some sense, you know, that gives you sort of, like I say, a get out of jail free card. Or you have that sort of, I am the hand of God. Therefore, anything I do is merely God's will. And somehow that doesn't seem to play often on the mind of those who are less religiously.
You know, it's funny. Whenever someone says, like, I am the instrument of God, or I have a chosen destiny, I think back to, like, you know, like Alexander the Great, who claimed he was a god.
True.
Or like Julius Caesar, who was, oh, he's Jupiter. It's just kind of funny when you say, I have the divine blessing, so what am I going to do with that? Well, I'm going to do morally reprehensible things. It doesn't that seem a little, like, that's the first thing they go for, is I can do these bad things, I can make these big decisions because God has vested in me certain power. Well, hold on a second. I thought the citizens of the country gave you the power.
Well, and that goes to the whole thing too. You know, is something moral because it's or something immoral, maybe a better way to put it, because it's wrong to do, or is it immoral or moral because God says you should or should not do that? In England, just recently, a couple of years ago, the British Farm Animal Welfare Council moved to ban ritual slaughter that was deemed to be cruel. And religious leaders came up with two defenses for it, right? One, I think, was a very valid one. You know, they argued that ritual slaughter isn't any more cruel or harmful than standard slaughtering for a meatpacking plant. And that's true. If they're equally, then they should be treated equally. But they had a second argument that I thought was quite interesting. They argued that it was fundamental to the religious practice, and that to stop it would be unethical and religious discrimination. But, I don't know, we already have things that are religious practices that we don't allow. I mean, human sacrifice, for example, or child abuse, you know, be it physical or sexual, isn't, even if you...
Well, that's not really a religious practice so much.
Well, no, if you go into, and I'm wanting to deal delicately here, the age of consent in some religious sects is what we would consider to be immoral.
Yeah. Right?
You know, and again, that just shows you that even society as a whole points out, it says, well, irrespective of what the religious standards, we have our own natural inborn sense of what is a moral or immoral act. And we quite often will alter our religious views to incorporate that natural moral sense.
And I suppose if you lived in an older Christian society, perhaps one that was based on conquest, you would assume a more aggressive stance of Christianity, which I believe actually happened during the Crusades. Whereas if you live in a more peaceful area of time, you might assume a more conciliatory stance on Christianity. So I guess the question is, it's not so much the religion, it's the people who are interpreting it. And they can just meld it and change the meaning whenever they feel like it.
Well, I think this goes back to where this kind of started from. I think in the one sense, to take the hard form of the case, religion can actually be a force of immorality in the sense that it provides you cover, shelter. Female genital mutilation is a religious practice. It's a horribly immoral thing, but you can use this religious shield that says, oh, but we can do this because it's ordained by our religious practice. Whereas if you didn't have that shield, there's no way in the world you could really justify it.
No. And that, I mean, I personally would say that that kind of religious practice is about power and control. And it's people who are in charge and making decisions based on how can we get away with this? And let's get away with it by saying it's religious, it's divine, it's we have the hand of God on our side. And I suppose you can make that argument with other things like torture as well. You know, we're the good guys because we believe in God. So to protect, you know, God's land, we're going to do morally reprehensible things. But we have the favor of God, so we're okay.
I'm just going to mention two last little study notes that I have here. One is the Burna Research Group did a poll of divorce rates among conservative Christians, and they found that divorce amongst them was significantly higher than amongst atheists and agnostics. And one of the things they keep saying, well, religion helps keep the family together. Family values, if anything, it seems to be a religious value. It's family values. But they are up to, what was it, 27% for the religious, very religious, to 20% for the atheists or agnostics. And another one, this was published in the Journal of Religion and Society, and it says, and I'm quoting here, in general, higher rates of belief in or worship of a creator correlates with higher rates of homicide, juvenile and early adult mortality, STV infection rates, teenage pregnancy, and abortion, and at least in prosperous democracies. And I mean, again, they're just pointing to the United States. The United States so gets kicked on if it's not for economic reasons, because they don't have health care, and it's for the moral majority. In some ways, I feel so sorry for the Americans. Not a bad country, not a bad people, but you can be such the kicking post sometimes.
Yeah, and we should point out that statistics can not always give you the correct view. Sometimes, you know, they can be read wrong. And perhaps maybe our listeners think we've read these ones wrong. And if they do, they can email us at radio.freethinker@gmail.com. They can read our blog at ubcfreethinkers.blogspot.com. And they can follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. So we're wrapping down on the last bit of our time here. So let's go to a skeptical quote. And I have this quote here for us. It's a really good one by Sam Harris. And he writes, or says, "The moderation that we see among non-fundamentalists is not some sign that faith itself has evolved. It is, rather, the product of many hammer blows of modernity that have exposed certain tenets of faith to doubt."
Excellent. I think that goes perfectly with our idea of morality and how we shape morality.
Yes, it's a very, very good point by Sam Harris. Well, we're almost out of time, so I will say...
This is Don saying, eyes open, brains on.
Yes, and now I will say, this is Ethan, the free-thinking historian, and I will say, good luck and good night.
You said that.
Yeah, I said that. All right, see you later.
I'm gonna be round my vegetables, I'm gonna chow down my vegetables. I love you most of all, my favorite vegetable.
Sprouts, it's your 75-cent coffee fix in the sub.
It's your source for reasonably priced, creatively named stew and vegan brownies.
It's your purveyor of bicycle-delivered local produce.
It's also a place where volunteers can realize their vision of responsible business and where like-minded students can explore UBC's food systems.
Hark! Sprouts is currently accepting applications for next year's executive board and is encouraging ambitious, creative, and disciplined students from all faculties and year levels to apply.
Come by Sprouts in the sub-basement to learn more about our projects and how to get involved.
I tried to kick the ball, but my tinny flew right off. I'm red as a beet, 'cause I'm so embarrassed.
This is Phil Plait of BadAstronomy.com, and I'll be a guest on an upcoming Radio Free Thinkers show. Take some time and listen in. Radio Free Thinkers are on every Tuesday at 4 p.m., here on CITR 101.9 FM.
Then there's the utter misery that is college radio, where they apparently just let any bewildered freshman wander into the booth and try to run a radio station. Campus Outreach is looking for... Hang on. College radio can pretty much be summed up in five words.
CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.